Looking for more than just pain relief? At Ability Chiropractic, we help your body do what it was designed to do, heal naturally. Our doctors focus on spinal and nervous system alignment to restore balance, energy, and overall wellness. From infants to grandparents, families across Columbus are discovering that true health starts from within, not from a prescription bottle. Experience what natural healing can do for you. Book your appointment today at AbilityChiro.com. That's AbilityChiro.com.
During the Right Rug Flooring Anniversary Sale, we're celebrating 91 years of the guaranteed lowest prices. With beautiful carpet with a lifetime stain warranty starting at $219 a square foot installed with pad. And luxury vinyl starts at $399 a square foot installed. Unbeatable prices and 24-month special financing available with approved credit. Schedule a free in-home appointment with our flooring experts at RITERUG.com. Right Rug Flooring's Anniversary Sale.
Right.
Let's talk.
John Brown.
The Golden Throne, The Curse of a King, is a groundbreaking present tense reconstruction of the life and world of one of the most consequential and influential figures in world history, Suleiman the Magnificent. It is the latest book from Christopher de Bellaigue, and I'm delighted to say that he joins me live on the line now. Christopher, good morning to you.
Thanks a lot for having me, sir.
The pleasure's all mine. Are you sort of somewhere near Constantinople, then?
I am in moral terms, in psychological terms, very close to Constantinople, but in geographical terms, Giles, and of course I'm going to call you Giles from now on.
Thank you.
Giles, I am very near Olympia in West London.
Ah, indeed. I said Olympia, I suddenly think of the Oracle of Delphi is going to come into this one, but there you go. Now, so, I forgot to forewarn you, by the way, Christopher, that I am that worst sort of creature. I'm an armchair historian. So when this landed on my desk, I was like, oh, for goodness sake, because we, from a Western, it's a really interesting take on history, because we look at European history from that sort of Mediterranean basis view, and we tend to think that it's all Central European, and we don't look at the Mediterranean as an entity per se, and we certainly don't look at sort of North Africa, the Maghreb, going all the way through to Alexandria and then up the Levant as being part of Europe. And we certainly think that the Ottomans are sort of Turkish delight eating sort of fat sultans who basically are going to completely muck up Western civilization. So, if you could, Christopher, if you think that's a fair point of view to start from, give me Ottoman 101. One at this particular point.
Well, I tell you, Giles, you've got to get out of your armchair and get on the treadmill, because there's a lot of things that need to change. But also where you're sitting in Spain. I'm surprised that this point of view should prevail, because Spain was at the time we're talking about, which is the 16th century. Spain was part of the Habsburg Empire. Charles V was the ruler of Spain, and Charles V was engaged in this incredible civilizational conflict with who? Not with Francis of France, not with Henry VIII of England, because they were small fry, but with Suleiman the Magnificent of Istanbul, because he was the only other monarch in the world who could possibly claim to be a world monarch. So that is the starting point of this entire trilogy about Suleiman. He is the bottom point of this diamond of European monarchs, with Charles and Suleiman being the most important.
You see, if you mention Ottoman people, they're just going to think Turkey, but it's so much more than that, isn't it? And the Ottoman Empire stretches to, well, modern Hungary, isn't it, basically? I mean, we've got, is it now? Here, I'm going to get this completely wrong. Is it the Janissaries?
The Janissaries. So the Janissaries were the great crack infantry force. They were the best and the most feared infantry force in Europe. So the important thing to think about is that Suleiman is he sits at the navel of the world. From where he sits in Istanbul or Constantinople, as it was before the Ottoman period, he can see, and he must dominate, otherwise he will be destroyed by not only Europe, but also Iran and the Caucasus and North Africa. He's in an incredible position at juncture in Europe. So he's a European, but also he's not a European. And if you think of, if you say, well, what do you think about Britain? And you think about the nation state of Britain, and then you compare what Britain was when it had an empire. This is what we're talking about with the Ottomans. Turkey is the rump nation state that was bequeathed by a Muslim empire.
And so are we, what sort of organization? I mean, obviously it's an empire. Are the Ottomans doing the thing that all great empires should do? Is it pretty much as, for example, the Persians did when they were heading towards, you know, the Athenians and Sparta when it could be bothered to get off its proverbial. Are they letting the various bits of the empire sort of pretty much run themselves, or is it top heavy sort of, you will do this way?
It's quite interesting, because this is a very important point. In Suleiman's time, the empire achieved its greatest extent in terms of territorial land. So they almost take India. They don't quite, but they take Yemen. They have much of the Crimea. They have all of the Balkans. They have half of Hungary, much of North Africa. And what Suleiman does is he standardizes and he imposes a kind of Act Ottomana. And that means that you have similar administration, you have laws are being standardized, and you have a very efficient mode of government. And the Ottomans under Suleiman are like the Rolls Royce of monarchies. They are purring along incredibly efficient.
Because here's the thing. I mean, we can all get very excited about elite crack infantry units and, you know, dusky maidens in harems and whatever, but no empire can function without tax gatherers, without logistics, without the guys who go around and pick up the money. So how does that work in the terms of this age?
You're absolutely right. There's an enormous administration that has been developed over centuries. But actually, I can hear your listeners switching off when you're talking about tax gathering.
But it's important.
You're moving away from the dusk.
But it's important.
Moving away from the dusky maidens in the harem.
Yeah.
And the Lion House and the Golden Throne have incredible characters. Many of them are in the harem, and they are all fantastic characters. Many of them are slaves. That's the other massive institution. So one of the great problems with our age is that we think that slavery was invented by the British, and it's only transatlantic. Slavery is one of the enduring institutions of world history since the beginning of recorded time. The Ottoman take on slavery was very interesting. They would go into a new territory, they would levy slaves, young men, they would take them away and they would give them an incredible education. And often these boys would end up the Grand Vizier, that is to say, the Prime Minister, the most powerful man underneath the Sultan. It was an incredible rags to riches story. And the same is true of the Sultan's concubines who ended up his wives.
But also, I mean, slavery, I mean, it's not only, I mean, corsairs, for example, in the Mediterranean, I mean, that's the word that gets banded around, people don't know, but, you know, you've got the Knights of Malta, the Hospitaliers, or whatever, I can never remember how you pronounce it correctly, all,
Hospitalers,
exactly, you know, and they basically, when they get kicked out of Rhodes, I mean, they're basically pirates and slavers for the best part of 100 something for years, aren't they? They're doing that for decades.
So Suleiman has this, he brings in this pirate called Hayreddin Barbarossa, who doesn't know much about Islam, but he is nominally a Muslim. And he brings him in and says, look, you have to sharpen up your Islamic observance, but in return, what we'll do is we will give you command of the galleys and you will become the chief admiral. And so Hayreddin Barbarossa engages in this extraordinary Mediterranean-wide campaign against, as you say, against the Hospitallers, against Charles V's standing fleet, and against all Christian shipping. And they do this to a large extent from North Africa. And North Africa becomes studded with these trading posts and booty-gathering places where also slaves are kept. And slaves, having been enslaved, they can be ransomed. And the Mediterranean is a very vast sea, but it's almost like a village. Everyone knows each other. Everyone knows what's happening at one end, from one end to the other. And it's all very personal. It's a really interesting story.
Is Istanbul now Istanbul? Is it Constantinople? Has it fallen? Is this Suleiman the Magnificent, the Suleiman who takes Constantinople and then weeps openly because of the destruction done?
Mehmet the Conqueror took Constantinople.
Right.
He turned it into Istanbul.
Yeah.
But it's only under Suleiman that you see, where those who have visited Istanbul today – Well, remember that incredible skyline. That is Suleiman's legacy. He turned Constantinople, really the Byzantium, the capital of Byzantium, into the capital of not only of the Ottoman Empire, but also of Islamic civilization. And so that is the sort of epicenter of everything that happens there. Everything radiates from Istanbul.
So everything radiates from Istanbul, but also there is squabbling. There have been a history of I mean, a lot of visas get their heads lopped off. But how precarious a position is the main our main protagonist in this? I mean, do you have, because the kids are never happy, are they, Christopher? Let's face it, they always think they can do a better job, or you know, or whatever.
So my kids are never happy. I don't know.
Yes, but with the greatest respect. Look, yeah, I know you might have Olympia, but you know.
Suleiman comes to the throne uncontested, but the only reason he comes to the throne uncontested is because his father Selim, who is justly and understandably known as Selim the Grim, has killed all his male relatives. So there is no one to contest the throne with Suleiman. When he comes to the throne, he is a very lucky Sultan, because he doesn't have to wade through blood to get there. And also the Christians are completely divided. Why are they divided? Because Charles V and Francis I don't get on, but also because the Reformation is happening and Martin Luther is raising hell in the center, the middle of Christendom. And that is a great opportunity for Suleiman to advance. Now, why the Golden Throne is subtitled as the Curse of the King is because great-grandfather Mehmet decreed that the rightful Sultan of the Ottomans has the legal right to kill all his brothers. And Suleiman has many, many sons. And he loves those sons. He's basically a family man. He has this wonderful concubine who becomes his wife. But he has a problem, because as he gets older, people start thinking, uh-oh, what's going to happen when he pops off his, when he falls off his perch? And so that is the moment at which his sons start to jockey for position and to prepare themselves for the extraordinary battle royal that will happen at the end. And so you see this man who's a family man, who's in denial. He doesn't want to think about this moment, and he's suddenly confronted with the awful reality that his sons are going to kill each other. And they don't wait for him to die for that to happen. That happens while he is still alive, because they have to preempt each other.
I'm just thinking, because, I mean, there used to be this sort of unholy scramble, you know, during Plantagenet times. Everybody was going to try and get to Winchester and say, right, I'm the king or whatever. Presumably, are all his progeny based in Istanbul? Are they within spitting distance or arrow shot distance or composite bow twang of each other? I mean, are they all quite close?
No, they are not. And that is an extremely important point. What happens to these boys is that when they get of an age, they're sent away with their mothers or on their own to become provincial governors. And that is where they cut their teeth. And so they get experience of administration, of fighting, of keeping down rebellions and that sort of thing. But essentially what they're doing is they're looking over the shoulder to see which brother is closest to Istanbul, because the process is exactly the same. You have to get to Istanbul first. And so a lot of time is spent in the Golden Throne, because the wife I mentioned has three able-bodied sons, all of them in contention. But she had a predecessor who was the Sultan's concubine, by whom he had a son, whom the Janissaries love, who is widely loved by the populace. And so what happens in the second half of his reign is that this rivalry ripens into this fully blown struggle for contention.
When you say the populace, I mean, are we, they don't have a say, do they? Is it just a question? Because if you, because I'm thinking back to, you know, when, you know, the again, this is Holy Roman Empire, so like Romans, etc., who obviously Constantinople is, but they keep, the Praetorian Guard keep knocking off emperors left, right, and center, especially sort of during the latter years of the empire. Do the population have any say? I mean, if you are an unpopular ruler in Ottoman times, but you may be popular with your elite infantry or Janissaries. I mean, is it a question of, well, you know, forget the ordinary Ottoman citizen? I mean, this is purely a matter for sort of high born pure blood.
I think there's a combination. Part of what you say is true, but I think partly the voice of the populace is heard, and it's heard through these institutions like the janissaries or like the religious institutions that are very, very important. And at this stage in the story, in the mid 16th century, Mustafa, who is Suleiman's eldest son and who has all the qualities you would want for in an emperor, he's athletic, he's good looking, he's generous, he is brave. He has a good work-life balance.
He's not going to make it, is he, Christopher? The way you're running it, he's not going to make it.
He writes poetry.
Oh, he's,
and
yeah,
Charles, I think you've just given away the spirit. That's awful what you've
done. No, but the way you say, he's brave, he writes poetry, he's kind to animals, everybody loves him, he's not going to make it. I mean, it's just, you know, it's going to be the guy at the back.
This is the awful thing about the Ottoman succession, and that's what the Golden Throne really is. It is succession... with a codpiece.
Aren't we missing out then on our history? Because again, I'm only just sort of discovering the Ottomans. The only reason I've come into the Ottomans is an unhealthy look at Carthaginians, Templars, and all that basin. Because I'm based in Al-Andalus, where with all the dynasties coming out.
Exactly.
So we're missing out on a huge chunk of European history, because if you look at the Ottoman Empire, they'll just think, oh, it's, you know, it's again guys with pointy shoes, and Byron goes and sees them at some point when they're in decline, and Albania or whatever. So how do you, what's your starting point, what's your entry point into this, Christopher, and bringing us into this fascinating and colorful tale?
My entry point personally was that I was living in Turkey for many years, and I would visit Istanbul. I was a journalist. I was covering contemporary Turkish politics at a time of, as is happening now, yeah, of immense change and convulsion. And I would look at Istanbul and think, who is the guy who built this place? And so that was my entry point. My entry point from the perspective of what you've just mentioned, and this is something that I beat the drum for, and I tour schools and I tell them, you must look at Tudor history in the round. You must look at it in a European context. And you have these other very interesting monarchs all doing their thing at exactly the same time. And then you put Tudor history into context. Now, we know that Henry VIII liked dressing up, as he put it, as the Turk. That was the extent of his involvement with Turkey. But Charles V, as we've discussed, Francis I of France, he did the most scandalous thing. He was so incensed with Charles V, who was his co-religionist, fellow Catholic, all the rest of it. He was so incensed with and full of rivalry with Charles that he did an alliance with Suleiman. And that was the most scandalous event of the 16th century, the Franco-Ottoman alliance against the Habsburgs. And that alliance lasted, the French alliance with the Turks lasted until Napoleon's invasion of Egypt in 1798, that lasted for a hell of a long time. So what I'm trying to do, I'm trying to get these worlds to meet. I did so. I had a wonderful book launch, Charles. I wish you'd been there. I had Damian Lewis, who played Henry VIII in the Wolf Hall TV adaptation, reading Suleiman. So I engineered a meeting between between Henry VIII and Suleiman, the first one. It never happened in real life, but I did it.
But it's really super as well, because I mean there are seismic shocks. You've just mentioned Luther, and then there's the German peasants' revolt, stroke war going on at the same time, and of course the papacy is not exactly having an easy time afterwards, and they're getting terribly worried that they're going to be what, Italy has gone completely banal. I mean, it doesn't exist as we think about it now, but it is a time of seismic shocks that we still feel the aftershocks and rumblings even today, Christopher.
Absolutely. The whole question of whether, for example, Britain is a part of Europe or not is beautifully answered in this period. You see Britain within Europe, you see it withdrawing from Europe, the break with the papacy, but Henry also being sucked back into European politics again and again and again. And I think that's an extremely important lesson. But also you see
in You mentioned the Pope, and
successive popes, they were
driven up the wall by disunion and division within Europe. And of course, they
hated the Reformation, they hated Luther, and Luther had a very good point, because of course the Catholic Church was completely corrupt at the time. But if you're trying to defend Christendom from the Turks, this incredible, to me, the great analogy is with Russia. Russia is one unified country. semi-imperium that does Putin's bidding. The Turkish Empire was the same. And only if you unite can you defend, can you defeat. And that's the only way you can do it. And so, again and again, we're having these lessons. But you look at Erdogan now, what's happening to him? He's under threat in Istanbul. He's under threat because of because he locked up the guy who
the mayor, the mayor, yeah.
The next president. But it's no coincidence that Erdogan is a fan of the Ottomans. He likes playing up the Ottoman legacy. And he's particularly fond. He's actually more fond. He's fonder of Suleiman's father, Selim, than he is of Suleiman. And Selim, let us not forget, is the guy who killed all the male relatives. So that tells you a little bit about Mr. Erdogan.
Isn't it funny, though, you think about Ataturk and the founding of Turkey, that's a whole new kettle of pescado over here. But, you know, and you would think that he would, you know, that new striving Turkey, and yet it's going back to those glory days of empire, etc. Strange, that, eh?
No, look, if you've had an empire and you've lost it, the default mode is nostalgia. It's how you deal with the wreckage of empire that defines you as a nation state. And we've all gone through it. Most nation states at some stage in their history have had empires or commanded empires. And the decline from empire, we're not the first to have gone through it. We won't be the last.
How do you get a timeline, a narrative, and make it? It is labyrinthine, and it is splendid in the best way. But I mean, and you obviously know your stuff. But to make it for the lay person, for the person who doesn't have that sort of that interior knowledge of the Ottomans, how do you steer up? How do you lead us gently by the hand through the harem, Christopher?
What I do is I go straight to the primary sources. That is to say, the sources that come from the very time, and I use them. And I don't go into historical controversies, and I don't talk about what happened next. I don't know as a narrator what's going to happen. I put you in the room with my characters, and they are characters. They are brought to life because we know what they look like, we know what they said, we know what they wrote, we know how they fought. And I put you in the room or on the battlefield or in the council chamber with my characters, and I essentially novelize history. It's history, it's complete history, but the way I write it is as if it were a novel. And that's how I bring in the non-specialist, the non-historian, someone who likes novels, someone who's just interested in a good story.
Please tell me, primary researchers, please tell me you're sitting there in with dusty tomes on the outskirts of Istanbul, thumbing through, you know, original correspondence from far-flung provinces.
Charles, I'll tell you that if you really want me to, but actually what I'm doing is I'm sitting in Olympia and I'm calling up all of these resources which have been digitized. You can get them all. So... you want to, there's an incredible Italian description of Suleiman going to war when he's leaving Istanbul. It describes everything down to the nth degree. And I called it up. I just Googled it. It exists in one manuscript form in the Venetian archive. There it was in front of me in facsimile on my screen. And that is the wonder of modern technology. It's the wonder of digitization, is that you have all of these incredible resources, the Ottoman chroniclers, the Venetian diaries. A lot of my sources are foreign. I have a lot of Persian sources, a lot of Turkish sources. Almost all of them are available online. And that is just an extraordinary privilege and pleasure to be able to use.
What are you hoping that people will take from the Golden Throne?
An appreciation of what an extraordinary empire the Ottoman Empire was, what an extraordinary ruler Suleiman was, but also I want people to engage. My big mission is for people to engage with history, to stop thinking of history as a way of fighting modern political battles. It's a way of getting in touch with our past, of contextualizing who we are, of contextualizing where we came from, and of feeling empathy and sympathy for people who are very, very different from ourselves. That is the great challenge of the historian.
I'm about to stand on my chair and applaud you for that one, Christopher. Absolutely. Because people say to me, why do you like history so much? It's just dusty things. I said, it's not. You don't understand. Listen. You may, I'm sure you've done that from Olympia. Now, you teased me there. Are we getting the next book then? You've got the Golden Throne. Do we then go on to, drum roll, Siege of Malta, favourite thing at the moment. The stand of the Christians and the Spanish come over too, and there are Venetians and there's boats everywhere.
You're absolutely right. But
actually, before the Golden Throne, we have the Lion House, which came out 3 years ago. So the Lion House is book one. That's young Suleiman, as it were. Middle years Suleiman is the Golden Throne. That's him at his pomp, but also facing this curse of the succession. And then we have what a friend of mine uncharitably referred to as the colostomy bag years.
Hurrah!
And that will be the that will be the fine.
I'm sure there was a young child from slavery who was brought up, was kidnapped by Barbarossa and said, you will carry the...
No, his final years are incredible. This is a guy who was on the throne of the Ottomans for 46 years. He campaigned every summer or every under the summer, and he died in the saddle. He was a big, big fighter.
The book is called The Golden Throne, The Curse of a King. It's by Christopher de Belleg, who we're talking to today. If people want to find you online, where's the best place to come and say wonderful things and also discover the rich, you know, like I said, to be led through the dusky slave girls, etc.?
You can do that. And yeah, I've got a website. People can contact me through that. I've got, I'm on Twitter, at BellegC. I'm very available. I'm very available.
The book is called The Golden Throne, The Curse of a King. Listeners, you can order it direct via our own virtual bookstore. Go forth and do that if you do nothing else today. It's by Christopher de Belleg. Christopher, as you can probably tell, it's been absolutely brilliant to speak to you today.
I'm so pleased to have you, Charles.
Many thanks for having me.
Looking for more than just pain relief? At Ability Chiropractic, they help your body do what it was designed to do, heal naturally. Their doctors focus on spinal and nervous system alignment to restore balance, energy, and overall wellness. From infants to grandparents, families across Columbus are discovering that true healing starts from within, not from a prescription bottle. Experience what natural healing can do for you. Book your appointment today at abilitychiro.com.
During the Right Rug Flooring Anniversary Sale, we're celebrating 91 years of the guaranteed lowest prices. With beautiful carpet with a lifetime stain warranty starting at $219 a square foot installed with pad. And luxury vinyl starts at $399 a square foot installed. Unbeatable prices and 24-month special financing available with approved credit. Schedule a free in-home appointment with our flooring experts at RITERUG.com. Right Rug Flooring's Anniversary Sale.